Chapter 25. After the episode had happened, I walked around the concourse until I found a tent where I could rent the use of a telephone for a few minutes. Everyone relied on phones now that the city's original elegantly swift data networks had stopped working. It was something of a comedown for a society whose machines had once elevated the art of communication into an effortless form of near telepathy, but the phones had become a minor fashion accessory in their own right. The poor didn't have them, and so the rich flaunted them. The larger and more conspicuous, the better. The phone I rented looked like a crude, military-hardened walkie-talkie, a bulky black handheld unit with a pop-up 2D screen and a matrix of scuffed push-buttons marked with Canadian characters. I asked the man renting the phone what I needed to do to reach both an orbital number and someone in the canopy. He gave me a long and involved explanation about both, the details of which I struggled to hold in my head. The orbital number was easier since I already knew it, engraved onto the mendicant business card which Sister Amelia had left me, but I had to get through 4 or 5 temperamental network layers before I reached it. The mendicants conducted their business in an interesting manner. They maintained ties with many of their clients long after they had left Hospice Idlewild. Some of those clients, on ascending to positions of power in the system, returned favors to the mendicants, donations which allowed them to keep their habitat solvent, but it went beyond that. The mendicants relied on their clients returning to them for additional services, information, and the something which could only be described as the politest kind of espionage, so it was always in their interests to be in easy reach. I had to walk out of the station, into the rain, before the phone was able to hook into any of the city's surviving data systems. Even then it took many seconds of stuttering attempts before an informational route was established to the hospice, and once our conversation began, it was punctuated by significant time lags and dropouts, as data packets ricocheted around near Yellowstone's space, occasionally arcing off on parabolas which never returned. "Brother Alexei of the Ice Mendicants, how may I serve God through you?" The face which had appeared on the screen was gaunt and lantern-jawed, the man's eyes gleaming with calm benevolence, like an owl. One of the eyes I noticed was surrounded by a deep purple bruise. "Well, well," I said, "Brother Alexei, how nice. What happened? Fell on your trowel?"
"I'm not sure I follow you, friend."
"Well, I'll jog your memory for you. My name is Tanner Mirabel. I came through the hospice a few days ago, from the Orvieto."
I'm not sure I recall you, brother."
"Funny, don't you remember how we exchanged vows in the cave?" He gritted his teeth, all the while maintaining that benevolent half-smile.
"No, sorry. Drawing a blank there, but please continue."
He was wearing an ice mendicant smock, hands clasped across his stomach. Behind him I was afforded a view of climbing step vineyards, which rose up and up until they curved overhead, bathed in the mirrored light of the habitat's sunscreens. Little chalets and rest places dotted the steps, blocks of cool white amidst the overwhelmingly florid green, like icebergs on a briny sea. "I need to speak to Sister Amelia," I said. "She was very kind to me during our stay, and she dealt with my personal affairs. I seem to remember you and she are acquainted." The look of placidity did not diminish. "Sister Amelia is one of our kindest souls. It does not surprise me that you wish to show your gratitude, but I am afraid she is indisposed in the cryo-crypts. Perhaps I can, in my own way, at least be of service, even if my own ministerings cannot even begin to approximate the degree of devotion tendered you by the divine Sister Amelia." "Have you hurt her, Alexei?"
"God forgive you."
"Cut the pious act. I'll break your spine if you've hurt her. You realize that, don't you? I should have done it while I had the chance." He chewed on that for a few moments before responding,
"No, Tanner, I haven't hurt her. Does that satisfy you?"
"Then get me Amelia."
"Why is it so urgent that you speak to her and not me?"
"I know from the conversations we had that Sister Amelia dealt with a lot of newcomers coming through the hospice, and I'd like to know if she ever remembered dealing with a mystic..." I started saying Quirrenbach, then bit my tongue.
"Sorry, didn't quite catch the name."
"Never mind, just put me through to Amelia." He hesitated, then asked me to repeat my own name again. "Tanner," I said, gritting my teeth. It was like we had only just been introduced.
Just a moment of your, patience, brother.
The look was still in place, but his voice had an edge of strain to it now. He lifted one sleeve of his frock, exposing a bronze bracelet into which he spoke, very softly and possibly in a tongue specific only to the mendicants. I watched an image appear on the bracelet, but it was far too small for me to identify anything other than a pink blur, which might have been a human face, and which might also have been Sister Amelia. There was a pause of 5 or 6 seconds before Alexei lowered the sleeve of his smock. Well?
I cannot reach her immediately, brother. She is tending to the slush, to the sick, and one would be sorely inadvised to interrupt her when she is so engaged, but I have been informed that she has been seeking you as much as you seek her.
Seeking me? If you would care to leave a message where Amelia may reach you? I killed the connection to the hospice before Alexei had completed his sentence. I imagined him standing in the vineyard, staring glumly down at whichever deadened screen he had been addressing, his words trailing off. He had failed. He had failed to trace me, as must have been his intention. Ryvich's people, it appeared, had also reached and infiltrated the mendicants. They had been waiting for me to resume contact, hoping that by some indiscretion I would reveal my location. It had almost worked. It took me a few minutes to find Zebra's number, remembering that she had called herself Taryn before revealing the name used by her contacts in the sabotage movement. I had no idea if Taryn was a common first name in Chasm City, but for once luck was on my side. There were less than a dozen people with that as first name. There was no need to phone them all, since the phone showed me a map of the city and only one number was anywhere near the chasm. The connection was much swifter than the one to the hospice, but it was far from instantaneous, and still plagued by episodes of static, as if the signal had to worm along a continent-spanning telegraphic cable rather than jump through a few kilometers of smog-laden air.
Tanner, where are you? Why did you leave?
I paused, on the verge of telling her I was near Grand Central Station, if that was not adequately obvious from the view behind me.
No, I'd better not. I think I trust you, Zebra, but you're too close to the game. It's better if you don't know.
You think I'd betray you?
No, although I wouldn't blame you if you did, but I can't risk anyone finding out via you.
Who's left to find out? You did a fairly comprehensive job on Waverly, I hear.
Her striped face filled the screen, monochrome skin tone offset by the bloodshot pink of her eyes. He played the game from both sides. He must have known it would get him killed sooner or later.
He may have been a sadist, but he was one of us.
What was I supposed to do? Smile nicely and ask them to desist? A warm squall of harder rain lashed out of the sky, and I moved under the ledged side of a building for protection, cupping my hand over the phone, Zebra's image dancing like a reflection in water. I had nothing personal against Waverly, in case you wondered, nothing that a warm bullet wouldn't have fixed.
You didn't use a bullet, from what I heard.
He put me in a position where killing him was my only option, and I did it efficiently, in case you were wondering. I spared her the details of what I had found when I caught up with Waverly on the ground. It would not change anything to know he had been harvested by the mulch.
You're quite capable of looking after yourself, aren't you?
I began to wonder when I found you in that building. Mostly they don't even make it that far. Certainly not if they've been shot.
Who are you, Tanner Mirabel?
Someone trying to survive, I said. I'm sorry about what I took from you. You took care of me and I'm grateful. And if I can find a way of repaying you for that and the things I took, I will.
You didn't have to go anywhere, Zebra said.
I said I'd offer you sanctuary until the game was over. I'm afraid I had business I had to attend to. It was a mistake. The last thing Zebra needed to know about was the business with Ryvich, but now I had invited her to speculate about just what it would take to bring a man out of hiding.
The odd thing is, she said, I almost believe you when you say you'll pay me back. I don't know why, but I think you're a man of your word, Tanner.
You're right, I said, and I think one day it'll be the death of me.
What's that meant to mean?
Never mind. Is there a hunt tonight, Zebra? I thought you might know, if anyone would.
There is, she said after consideration, but I don't see how it concerns you, Tanner. Haven't you learnt your lesson yet? You're lucky to be alive.
I smiled. I guess I'm just not sick enough of Chasm City yet. I returned the rented phone to its owner and considered my options. Zebra's face and the timbre of her voice lurked behind every conscious thought. Why had I called her?
There had been no reason for it except to apologize, and even that was pointless, a gesture more aimed at ameliorating my conscience than aiding the woman from whom I had stolen. I had been well aware how much my betrayal would hurt her, and well aware that I was not going to be able to pay her back at any point in the foreseeable future. Yet something had made me make that call, and when I tried to pare away my superficial motives to find what really lay below them, all I found was a mélange of emotions and impulses. Her smell. The sound of her laugh, the curve of her hips, and the way the stripes on her back had contorted and released when she rolled aside from me after our lovemaking. I did not like what I found, so I slammed the lid on those thoughts, just as if I had opened a box of vipers. I walked back into the crowds of the bazaar, letting their noise oppress my thoughts into submission, concentrating instead on the now. I still had money, I was still a rich man by mulch standards, no matter how little influence it counted for in the canopy. Asking around and comparing prices, I found a room for rent, a few blocks across the mulch, in what was apparently one of the less run-down districts. The room was shabby, even by mulch standards. It was one cubic corner element in a teetering eight-storied encrustation of structures, lashed around the footslopes of a major structure. On the other hand, it also looked very old and established, having gained its own parasitic layer of encrustations in the form of ladders, staircases, horizontal landings, drainage conduits, trellises, and animal cages. So while the complex might not be the safest in the mulch, it had obviously endured for some years and was unlikely to choose my arrival as a sign to start collapsing. I accessed my room via a series of ladder and landing traverses, my feet padding over rents in the wattle-like bamboo flooring, street-level dizzyingly far below. The room was lit by gas lamps, although I noticed that other parts of the complex were furnished with electricity, served by constantly droning methane-powered generators somewhere below, machines which were locked in furious competition with the local street musicians, criers, muezzins, vendors, and animals. But I soon stopped noticing the sounds, and when I drew the room's blinds, it became tolerably dark. The room contained no furniture except a bed, but that was all that I needed. I sat down on it and thought about all that had happened. I felt myself free of any houseman episodes for the time being, and that allowed me to look back on those that I had experienced so far, with something bordering on cool clinical detachment. There was something wrong about them. I'd come to kill Ryvich, and yet, almost accidentally, I was getting glimpses of something larger, something I didn't like the shape of. It wasn't just the houseman episodes, although they were a large part of it. Certainly they had begun normally enough. I hadn't exactly welcomed them, but given that I already knew roughly what form they were going to take, I thought I could ride them out. But it wasn't happening like that. The dreams, episodes now since they had begun to invade daylight, were revealing a deeper history, additional crimes which no one even suspected Sky had committed. There was the question of the infiltrator's continued existence. The sixth ship, the fabled Caliuche, and the fact that Titus Houseman had believed Sky to be one of the immortals. But Sky Houseman was dead, wasn't he? Hadn't I seen his crucified body in Nueva Valparaiso? Even if that body had been faked, it was a matter of public record that, in the dark days following the landing, he had been captured, imprisoned, tried, sentenced, and executed, all in full view of the people. So why did I have my doubts that he was really dead? It's just the indoctrinal virus screwing with your head, I told myself. But Sky wasn't the only thing troubling me as I fell asleep. I was overlooking a rectangular room, as if the chamber were a dungeon or baiting pit, and I was standing on some balconied observation gallery. The room was blindingly white, walled and floored in shiny ceramic tiles, but strewn with large glossy green ferns and artfully arranged tree branches, creating a tableau of jungle vegetation, and there was a man on the floor. I thought I recognized the chamber. The man was curled up in a fetal position, naked, as if he had just been placed there and been allowed to wake. His skin was pallid and was covered in a sheen of sweat, like sugar glazing. Gradually he raised his head and opened his eyes, looking around, and tried slowly rising to his feet. Tried, and then stumbled into another permutation of the huddle in which he had begun. He could not stand because one of his legs ended in a clean, bloodless stump just below the ankle, like the sewn-up end of a sausage. He tried again, and this time managed to reach a wall, hopping to get there before balance deserted him. There was a look of inexpressible terror on his face. The man started shouting, and then his shouts became more frantic. I watched him shiver, and then something moved on the other side of the room, in a dark alcove situated in one of the white walls. Whatever it was moved slowly and silently, but the man was aware of its presence, and now his shouts became shrieks, like the squealing of a pig being slaughtered. The thing emerged from the alcove on the other side of the room, dropping in a bundle of dark coils, thick as a human thigh. It still moved languidly, hooded head rising to test the air, and yet more of it struggled from the alcove. By now the man's screams were punctuated by sharp silences as he drew breath, a contrast which only served to heighten the dread in the sounds he made. And I felt nothing except a kind of expectancy, my heart tight in my chest, as the hamadryad moved towards the man, and there was nowhere he could run to. I woke, sweating. A while later I hit the streets. I had slept for most of the afternoon, and while I did not exactly feel refreshed, my mind certainly was in a worse state of turmoil than it had been before. I was at least not so crippled with tiredness. I moved through lazy mulch traffic, pedestrians, rickshaws, steam and methane-driven contraptions, the occasional palanquin, volantor, or cable car passing through, though never lingering for very long. I noticed that I attracted less attention than when I had first entered the city. Unshaven, my eyes sunk into tired sockets, I was looking more like I belonged in the mulch. The late afternoon vendors were setting up stalls, some of them already hanging lanterns in preparation for the coming dusk. A misshapen maggot-like methane-filled dirigible navigated ponderously overhead, someone lashed to a gondola beneath it calling out slogans through a megaphone. Broken neon images flickered over a projection screen hanging beneath the gondola. I heard what sounded like a muezzin call across the mulch, calling the faithful to prayer, or whatever observance they practiced here. And then I saw a man with pendulous jewel-studded ears, whose mobile stall was hung with small wicker baskets holding snakes of every size and color imaginable. When I watched him open a cage and prod one of the darker snakes, its coils shifting uneasily, I thought of the ceramic white room in my dream, which I now recognized as the pit where Kaweya kept the juvenile, and shivered, and wondered what any of it meant. Later, I bought a gun. Unlike the weapon I had stolen from Zebra, and then pawned, it was neither cumbersome nor conspicuous. It was a small pistol which I could comfortably slip into one of the pockets of the greatcoat. It was manufactured off-world. The gun fired ice slugs, bullets of pure water ice accelerated to supersonic speed by a captive jacket, which was driven down the barrel by a sequenced ripple of magnetic fields. Ice slugs did as much damage as metal or ceramic bullets, but when they shattered into the body, their fragments melted away invisibly. The main advantage in such a weapon was that it could be charged from any supply of reasonably pure water, although it worked best with the carefully pre-frozen cache of slugs in the weapon's manufacturer-supplied cryo clip. It was also nearly impossible to trace the owner of such a gun if a crime had been committed, making it an ideal assassination tool. It didn't matter that the slugs had no autonomous target-seeking capacity, or that they would not penetrate some kinds of armor. Something as absurdly powerful as Zebra's rifle would make sense as an instrument of assassination only if I got an opportunity to kill Ryvich from halfway across the city, which was very unlikely. It was never going to be the kind of kill where you sat in a window squinting through the telescopic sight of a high-powered rifle, waiting until the target intersected the crosshairs, his image wavering through kilometers of heat haze. It was always going to be the kind where you walked into the same room and did it with a single bullet at close range, close enough to see the whites of his fear-dilated eyes. Evening fell over the mulch. Apart from the streets in the area immediately around the bazaars, pedestrian traffic thinned out, and the shadows cast by the towering roots of the canopy began to assume an air of sullen menace. I got to work. The kid driving the rickshaw might have been the same one who had originally taken me into the mulch, or his virtually interchangeable brother. He had the same aversion to my planned destination as well, unwilling to ferry me where I wanted to go until I sweetened the proposition with the promise of a generous tip. Even then he was reluctant, but we set off anyway,
navigating through the darkening glade of the city at a pace which suggested he was more than eager to complete the journey and return home. Some of his nervousness rubbed off on me, because I found my hand wandering into the pocket of my coat to feel the comforting cold mass of the gun, reassuring as any talisman.
"What you want, mister? Everyone know this no good pot of mulch. You better stay out of it, you smart."
"That's what people keep telling me," I said, "so I suppose you'd better assume that I'm not as intelligent as I seem."
"I no say that, mister. You pay plenty fine. You plenty smart fella. I just give you good advice is all."
"Thanks, but my advice to you is to just drive and keep your eye on the road. Let me worry about the rest." It was a conversation killer, but I wasn't in much of a mood for idle banter. Instead, I watched the darkening trunks of the buildings creep past, their deformities beginning to assume a weird normality, a strange sense that this was how all cities were meant to look ultimately. There were parts of the mulch relatively uncovered by canopy, and parts where the density of the overlying structures could not have been any higher, so that the mosquito net itself was completely blocked out, and when the sun was at its zenith, none of its light permeated to the ground. These were supposedly the worst areas of the mulch, areas of permanent night where crime was the only law which mattered, and where the inhabitants played games which were no less bloody and cruel than those favored by the people who lived overhead. I could not persuade the rickshaw kid to take me into the heart of the slum zone, so I settled for being dropped on the perimeter, pocketed hand wrapped around the slug gun. I trudged through the ankle-deep rainwater for several minutes, until I reached the side of a building which I recognized from the description Zebra had given me, and then crouched in a niche which offered some protection from the rain. Then I waited, and waited, while the last meager traces of daylight vanished from the scene, and all the shadows merged conspiratorially into one great city-hugging pall of gloomy grey. And then waited, and waited again. Night fell across Chasm City, the canopy lighting up above me, the arms of the linked structures dimpled with light, like the glowing tentacles of phosphorescent sea creatures. I watched cable cars move through the tangle, their motion like pebbles skipping waves as they swung from line to line. An hour passed and I readjusted my position dozens of times, never finding one that was comfortable for more than a few minutes before cramps began to set in. I'd take out the gun and sight along it, and I allowed myself the luxury of wasting a slug, shooting at the side of the building across from me, anticipating the recoil and getting a feel for the weapon's accuracy or lack thereof. No one disturbed me, and I doubt that there was anyone close enough to hear the gun's high-pitched shots. Finally, however, they came.